Hello, my name is Stanley Bill. You're listening to Notes from Poland.
This week, I'm talking to Timothy Garton-Ash, acclaimed historian and witness of Poland's transformations over the last half century. We'll be talking about the historic events of 1989 and what it all means 30 years later.
NotesFromPoland.com is the leading English language source of news, insight, and analysis on Poland. In this podcast, I look at the country from all angles: politics, history, culture, and society. You can get more news and the deeper stories about Poland at NotesFromPoland.com. My guest today is Timothy Garton-Ash, who is Professor of European Studies at the University of Oxford, Isaiah Berlin Professorial Fellow at St. Anthony's College, Oxford, and a Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's the author of 10 books of political writing on the transformations of Europe over the last half century. His essays appear regularly in the New York Review of Books and in The Guardian, among many other publications. And we're proud that he is also a member of the advisory board of the Notes from Poland Foundation. Timothy, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
We're coming to the end of a year celebrating the 30th anniversaries of the Central and Eastern European peaceful revolutions of 1989. You were there to witness some of the key moments. You've written about them in your book, The Magic Lantern, which has been expanded and republished this year. How do you look back at the moment of 1989 today? And how would you describe the evolution of your perspective on this moment as we move further away from it in time?
So in spite of all the problems, it's still celebration. It was an extraordinary moment with a kind of magical acceleration from the hard struggles in Poland, really all the way from John Paul II's first visit in 79, the birth of Solidarność in 1980, all the way through to the round table and the semi-free election of the 4th of June 1989, but then accelerating through Hungary and East Germany to the magical conclusion in the Laterna Magica Theatre, the Magic Lantern Theatre in Prague, which gives the title to the book. I still regard it as the best year in European history. I challenge you to name a better year. Something quite extraordinary. A nuclear-armed post-totalitarian empire is dismantled in the space of 3 years with hardly a shot fired in anger. You know, at the beginning, in the first years, people talk a lot about liberal triumphalism. Actually, we were quite nervous about how things were going to develop. And if you look at the last pages of the original book published in January 90, I'm kind of worried about how things will go. 10 years on, we felt there was a lot to celebrate. After all, Poland, Hungary, and the Czech Republic had just become members of NATO. 20 years on, in 2009, even more to celebrate because all the rest of Central and Eastern Europe had come into both the EU and NATO. But already the beginnings of doubt and worries about the way things were going. 30 years on, I've now traveled around the whole region again, and it's a very different feeling, a questioning of what went wrong.
To stick with 1989 for a moment, one thing that really strikes me in the book is when you say that the outcome of the June 1989 elections in Poland, for example, was very far from a foregone conclusion at the time, as it might appear in hindsight. So these are the first semi-free elections in Poland. You describe being with some of the key figures from the opposition, Adam Michnik and Jacek Kuroń, on the day of the elections, and that they were very far from certain about the outcome of the elections on that day. So I was wondering if you could take us back to the sense of the mood in June 1989. How vulnerable the developing transition appeared at that time. How reversible and fragile, or did it really seem that a wave was gathering that crashed after the results of those elections?
So, Henri Bergson, the philosopher, has a great phrase: "The illusions of retrospective determinism." The almost irresistible temptation to think that what actually happened somehow had to happen. So everybody now regards the Brexit vote in the 2016 referendum as somehow inevitable. It was nothing of the kind. And the same is true of 1989. It's very difficult for historians to overcome this temptation. The historians go about explaining what happened, which suggests somehow that it ought to have happened. At the time, you have to remember that we thought there'd be the Soviet bloc for another 10, 20, 30 years. We thought there'd still be a Berlin Wall in 2019. And everything that was being done was unprecedented, so that, to get to the roundtable talks in early 1989 was already unprecedented. Yeah. I remember Bronislav Geremek, a great architect, really, of the roundtable talks, saying to me, I have this in my notebook, maybe in 5 years' time we could get to a free election if we're very lucky. And at every stage, things go farther, faster, and more peacefully.
Well, of course, one interesting question then is, of course, there were voices at that time, including, for example, the recently deceased father of Poland's current prime minister, so Kornel Morawiecki, who was a member of a more radical wing of Solidarity, who were saying at the time, and many associated with the current government, who would say in hindsight, that there was an excessive caution about the mainstream liberal Solidarity circles like those associated with Bronisław Geremek at that time, and that therefore the transition was not accelerated in the way that it should have been then. Would you place any credence in those kinds of interpretations, or do you view those interpretations? Obviously, in the case of Morawiecki, he was a radical who was saying that at the time, Morawiecki Sr. But with respect to the more mainstream critique that peace sometimes delivers of the transition, what would be your response to those critiques?
So I have in front of me in my office in Oxford as we speak the protocol of the roundtable talks, and somebody called Lech Kaczynski features prominently in yes. precisely those talks. Yes. Both the Kaczynski brothers were involved in and committed to the process of the roundtable talks. So there's something frankly hypocritical about the retrospective critique. But more important than being hypocritical, it is profoundly ahistorical. It takes as given the situation from 1990 onwards that Gorbachev and the Soviet leadership would accept the changes, which none of us knew at the time, including the Kaczynskis. The Soviet Union had the power to crack down, to stop the process at any point in 1989, up to and including the fall of the Berlin Wall.
But did anybody think that would happen?
Yes, absolutely we did. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I remember vividly coming back to the offices of Gazeta Wyborcza on the evening of the 4th of June. We were rather upbeat about the elections because clearly there was a good turnout for Solidarity. And seeing on a tiny television screen in black and white in the corner of the offices, the first footage from Tiananmen Square.
Of course.
The students being carried out, dead students or wounded students, on doors, which you will remember was exactly what happened on the Baltic coast in 1970. We were absolutely shaken by that. And from that moment on, all over East Central Europe, the phrase one kept hearing was the Chinese solution. We must avoid the Chinese solution. It was entirely possible still that the Soviet Union would have cracked down. And if the Solidarity leadership had pushed too far too fast, it would have greatly increased the chances of a crackdown.
Speaking of the Kaczynski brothers, did you come across them during your early visits to Poland in the 1980s?
Yes, very briefly, but never got to know them properly. But I think it's important to say that unlike some figures who are prominent now in other countries in the region, they were genuinely part of the opposition movement. And
yes.
The part of the critique of 1989 that comes from peace, where I think there's a grain of truth in it, is not enough was done to confront the difficult past. I remember vividly that people like Tadeusz Mazowiecki and Adam Michnik had in front of their eyes the Spanish example, the transition to democracy in Spain after Franco, where the formula was, as you remember, amnesty and amnesia. Forget about the past, just look to the future. And with hindsight, I think that was a great mistake. I think that Poland should have done a truth commission to accompany its Velvet Revolution.
So something almost on a South African type of model, is that what you would have in mind?
Yes, with perhaps the difference, exactly, like South Africa or Latin America, but a symbolic public confrontation with the difficult past. I think you couldn't, having done a negotiated transition, simply turn around and put General Jaruzelski on trial the day after. That was the deal, that you had a negotiated transition. But you could have put him in front of a truth commission where, under oath, he had to both explain and publicly acknowledge what had been done, for example, in martial law. And I think with hindsight, that was a mistake made by my friends from, so to speak, the liberal moderate wing of Solidarity.
So the absence of that closure, in a way, created this sense of historical injustice.
So the effect of such a process is, you remember the famous phrase, gruba kreska. Now, I think
the thick line.
Gruba kreska, the thick line, in a slightly different sense. The effect of some sort of acknowledgement, some public process of confronting a difficult past, is to draw a clear line between past and present. And the failure to do that opened the opportunity for the Law and Justice Party to actually start its program from the premise that what happened in 1989 was not the true revolution, and that we still needed a revolution. So this issue of the unconfronted, the unmanaged past was not marginal to the way in which the Law and Justice ideology and program was built. It was absolutely seminal to it.
Well, to come to the present, indeed, because that's part of the newly published version of your book, in the new sections, as you reflect on 1989, you assert or really take for granted that somebody looking at Central and Eastern Europe today, and particularly at Poland and Hungary, might well ask what had gone wrong since the moment of 1989 and then the extraordinary development in the decades that followed. So before I asked you what factors have contributed to this change in direction, I do want to press you on that analysis, because after all, many voters in Poland today think that nothing has gone wrong since Law and Justice has come to power. They voted for the party in record numbers in the elections of October this year. And in fact, many would argue that the country is finally on the right track. I gather that you disagree. Why? What would you say is wrong with Poland under peace?
So I'm very glad you asked that question, because I think it's important to distinguish between two things which get confused in the debate. One is having a party in power which is very conservative, some critics would even say reactionary, strongly Catholic, socially conservative, definitely nationalist, and has a conservative traditional idea of Europe. I may like it or dislike it, but that is totally legitimate and fine.
Actually, to interrupt for the benefit of our listeners, I actually remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you wrote something along those lines straight after peace was elected in 2015 in The Guardian, something along the lines of, one may not agree with what this party stands for, but they've won an election fair and square and they have a right to bring in their policies. Is that something?
Exactly. Yes. So it's something I said at the time, unlike and was criticized for it by many sort of liberal Polish friends. But absolutely, that's democracy.
Precisely.
I didn't particularly like Mrs. Thatcher's government either, but that's democracy.
Yeah.
But I want to distinguish between that, which is fine, and the nature of the problem, what I mean when I say what went wrong, which is the erosion of the still fragile pillars and foundations of liberal democracy, such that if things go wrong, worse than they are at the moment in Poland, you will reach the situation in Hungary, which is much further down the road of the erosion of liberal democracy, where actually an opposition party does not have a free and fair chance of winning a national election because, for example, the media are so effectively under the control of Viktor Orban and the Fidesz party. Because arrangements for party funding, because the state administration is so politicized, I would argue that Hungary is simply no longer a democracy. So that's the what went wrong part. It's fine for the other team to win the game of football. What is not fine is for the playing field no longer to be level.
And you would say, with respect to elections, at least in Poland, at this point in time, I mean, you've made this distinction between Hungary and Poland, that in Hungary, the opposition does not have a realistic chance, although formally speaking, there are free elections at present. That's not how you would describe the situation in Poland at present.
That is the danger in Poland. The takeover of public television, TVP, which has effectively become a propaganda arm of the ruling Law and Justice Party, that's not hyperbole, is a very worrying development. But what you haven't had is kind of the major changes in electoral law that you saw in Hungary because the ruling party had a constitutional majority, the gerrymandering, and the media landscape in Poland is still, thanks to the existence of the newspaper I mentioned, Gazeta Wyborcza, born in 1989, thanks to the internet, major news and information sites, and most of all, thanks to the existence of a major independent news and information television channel, TVN, TVN 24. And I think that media pluralism is a crucial bulwark of liberal democracy, such that this year, in the parliamentary election and next year, I think in the presidential election, there is actually still a perfectly good chance for the opposition to win the election, if only it could get its act together.
So the public media may well be under party control, but Poland still does have a very vibrant private media landscape. There are, however, regularly noises that come out of the ruling party to suggest that there is a desire to introduce legislation that might in various ways serve to control some of these private media. Does this concern you? Do you see this as a serious threat?
Enormously concerning. So something I quote in the book in the Magic Lantern is a story Jacek Kuron told me from the roundtable talks, when conversation turned to the ZOMO, the notorious riot police, which played such a bad role during martial law. And they were also talking about television. And a member of the Central Committee said to him, "We would rather give you the ZOMO than give you television." So they understood just how crucial television was to the maintenance of power. And the interesting thing is, for all that we talk all the time about the internet, television still plays a crucial role in these societies. Now, it is absolutely clear and explicit that Jarosław Kaczyński would like to follow the Viktor Orban model, what I call Orbanization a la Polonaise. And getting control of the media is a key part of that. And the motto under which they'll try and do this is the Polonization of the media. What they're already saying is it's really unacceptable and illegitimate that so much of our media should be in foreign hands. Now, this is an interesting one because in principle, we're also concerned about the foreign ownership of media in Britain. In practice, the foreign ownership of key independent media is now one of the most important bulwarks of liberal democracy in Poland.
We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, we'll be talking about the success of the Law and Justice Party and the mistakes of the Polish transition. There has never been a more important time to understand Poland. At notesfrompoland.com, we're dedicated to providing comprehensive coverage of Polish current affairs, society, culture, and history, as well as regular analysis and opinion from a wide range of expert authors. But we can't do all this without your support. Every donation to our independent non-profit foundation helps our editorial team to create new content, from breaking news stories to deeper insight pieces. By supporting our work, you'll be part of our mission to bring the full picture on Poland to the world with no paywall. Please consider making a donation at notesfrompoland.com.
So, PiS is a party that's introducing changes that you and many other critics would suggest threaten the liberal democratic order. And yet, I think it's fair to say now that it's the most successful party in post-1989 Polish politics. It's had one whole term of government, a half term in 2005 to 2007, and now it's won another term with a record proportion of the vote. Why is the party so attractive to so many voters?
So we live in an age of populism, of successful populisms. And what peace has in common with Trump in the US or the Brexit movement here or other populism, Salvini in Italy, is that they are political entrepreneurs who put together different sections of society with different grievances and discontents and unite them behind a simplistic, emotionally appealing nationalist narrative. The good change.
Yep.
It's a slogan in Poland. So that they have in common with all other populisms. Then you have to look at the particular ingredients, which are, of course, different from place to place. And here I think that what PiS has succeeded in doing is putting together a right-wing cultural nationalist and socially conservative agenda, which was always going to have a big appeal because of Polish history, tradition, political culture, a country catapulted into a, you know, modern or even postmodern Western Europe, secular, extremely liberal, and social policies and indeed economic policies that might traditionally be described as left-wing.
Precisely.
And Fed Plus, the 500 plus.
Yes.
500 zlotys for now for each child is a good example of that. I quote in my new chapter a student of Warsaw University, a sympathizer of PiS. Interesting, by the way, young, highly educated students at Warsaw University who are very much on the right. And he said that 500 zlotys is not just an economic contribution to a poor family, it's also a gesture of recognition. It gives them some dignity. And PiS talk about, as you very well know, the redistribution of dignity. And there I think they picked up on a real failing of liberalism.
So this is a genuine mistake of the transition as you see it?
Of the later years of the transition.
Uh-huh.
That is to say, a lot of people now go back and say, oh, it was neoliberalism, oh, it was shock therapy. No one has yet described to me how else you were going to transform a command economy into a market economy. I'm sure
Indeed. In
detail it could have been done differently, but there were two mistakes made. First of all, the lack of a stronger social policy, which analysts like Alexander Smolar pointed to as a necessity right at the beginning, which Jacek Kuron, as the Minister for Social Affairs, personified. At the beginning of the transition, remember, Kuron was the left hand of the transition, Leszek Balcerowicz was the right. And what happened in Poland was that the right hand went on working away, but we lost the left hand,
yes,
the hand of social policy. And then on top of that, this thing that actually has happened more broadly with liberalism across the developed world, which is, it was not just a social and economic inequality, it was what I call the inequality of attention and respect, that there was a half of our society that simply felt ignored, not noticed by the metropolitan liberal elites, and
specifically
in the Polish case, the intelligentsia.
And of course, it's also possible for political entrepreneurs, as you describe them, to really ensure that people feel that by pointing it out, by pointing out this lack of respect and constantly hammering that message, something that people have a sense of already. And then once that's emphasized in political messaging, then it becomes even clearer.
And they are, of course, those populist entrepreneurs are themselves part of that very elite that they are criticizing.
Yes.
Be their names Nigel Farage, Marine Le Pen, Donald Trump, or Jarosław Kaczynski. But nonetheless, you know, George Orwell says somewhere one should be most critical of one's own side. And I think one really does have to acknowledge that failing across East Central Europe, but particularly in Poland. Interestingly, you know, the last platforma government actually considered doing the 500 zloty payments and decided against it.
For what reasons?
So there were a couple of reasons given internally. One was, are we sure we can afford it? To which I think the answer is probably yes, you can.
We certainly can now, but perhaps the Polish budget couldn't then. There may be that difference.
Interesting question. I mean, I think it is a fair point that the populace in Poland and elsewhere are throwing money around as if there were no tomorrow. So, for example, the pension reform, bringing back down the pension age, I think is unaffordable in an aging population. Not so sure about the 500 zlotys, but the other argument was, in fact, ideological, which is you can't just go out handing out cash to people.
Yeah, so that was the classic sort of liberal economic argument, which is what Peel represented at that time.
That is right. And if I may just add a point there, because I think it's important. If you say the word liberalism or liberalny in Poland today, people think it's economic liberalism you mean. So it was not just the specific economics of the transition. It was the way liberalism was reduced to the single dimension of economic liberalism. A one-dimensional liberalism is not liberalism at all.
I think that's very interesting, this left-right mixture that we see in PiS. With respect to the social policies and the redistributive policies, PiS has effected an enormous shift in Polish politics in general, that no party went to the last elections without offering something to the electorate and without promising to maintain PiS's promises, including PEOR, Civic Platform, the former Liberal Economic Party, that also changed their tune. So that seems to have shifted in Poland, that liberal economics is no longer the mainstream. The zeitgeist has moved. To broaden the conversation to the European scene in general, the situation in Poland is just one part of a broader set of processes. You've talked about the mistakes of liberals across the continent and the need for a new defense of liberalism or even a new form of liberalism. What do you have in mind, and do you see this process beginning?
So the process starts with self-criticism, which is something liberals are rather good at. I discovered the other day that the first book called Self-Criticism of Liberalism was published by a German author in 1846. So we've been at it a long time. And actually, we've now had about 20 books.
Do you think liberals got worse at self-criticism, though, over a certain period of time, and there was something of a self-satisfaction?
So I think that one of the things that went wrong with liberalism in the 1990s and particularly the 2000s was that it ceased to be self-critical and became, in a way, a closed ideology. Mm-hmm. A system internally consistent and coherent, but increasingly at odds with reality, as communism had been. And so it acquired some of the fatal flaws of a closed ideology. So we have to now, I've now read 20 books on the death of liberalism, which is one reason I'm sure that liberalism is still alive, right? Because it's capable of, you know, in the 1980s, we didn't read many books on the death of communism, which was both symptom and cause of the death of communism. So we've done the self-criticism bit, and we have a fairly clear idea of the kinds of things that went wrong. We've talked about a few of them. I mean, if I had to summarize another one in a single sentence, it would be that in quite rightly paying a lot of attention to the problems of the other half of the world, we didn't pay enough attention to the other halves of our own societies.
Yeah.
And so now we have to turn back and look at their concerns and take them seriously.
A blindness to growing inequalities and these
of multiple kinds, and to just the concerns of, and by the way, for us, both of us working in universities, you know, one of the great liberal ideas was to put more people into higher education. So now we have sort of 50% of our societies plus minus in higher education, and the unintended consequence is to split our societies down the middle, 50-50. One of the best predictors about how people would vote in the Brexit referendum was whether you had higher education or not. Those with higher education vote for Remain, those without vote for Leave. So we have to pay a lot more attention to the concerns of the other halves of our societies. What we now have to do is to turn that into a policy package, which in turn has to become a manifesto that wins an election. So it's a kind of three-step process, the fundamental rethink, which we're engaged in, the policy formulation, and then the politics. And the policy formulation has to take account of not just of the things we got wrong in the past, but of the new challenges coming our way, like competition from China, like climate change, like digital and AI, which is going to transform the world of work. So that's the stage I think we're at.
We're at stage one of three in your scheme.
We're at stage one going on two, which is why the other thing we have to do is to recognize that this is going to be a longer struggle. It's not going to be social democratic or liberal parties just coming up with all the answers and winning the next election. I suspect, unless the opposition comes up with a stunning new candidate in Poland, that Mr. Duda will win the presidential election in 2020, and we're looking 2, 3, 4 years ahead. So we shouldn't be dispirited by a few more populist nationalist victories. We should expect that and prepare for maybe the election after next.
I think it's also important to note in that context that Poland's economy is going so extraordinarily well that as poor as the opposition was in the recent electoral campaign, even a very strong opposition may have struggled to knock out an incumbent in that type of situation where the country's going very well and people are in general happy with that, what seems like a change. That's certainly what opinion polls seem to suggest. Well, I want to ask one last question before we finish. So when we look back to 1989 today and Poland in 1989, what lessons do you think we can still take from this historic moment in Poland and its region?
May I start with one lesson that we shouldn't take?
Please do.
Which is extremely now widespread in the European and general Western discourse, which is, oh, this is just Eastern Europe going back to its bad old ways. Authoritarianism is effectively in the DNA of quote-unquote Eastern Europe, no longer called Central Europe. As you know very well, as the historian Larry Wolf shows in his book, Inventing Eastern Europe, these are old Western stereotypes that go all the way back to the Enlightenment. And those are coming back very strongly now. And that's definitely the wrong lesson to learn.
I agree.
The right lesson to learn is, I think, that, as I put it in the book, freedom's battle is never finally won, that it has to be fought again in every generation. And what we have to address in Central Europe is, in a sense, partly the continued legacies of 40 years of communism that haven't fully been overcome, partly the mistakes of the transition that we've been talking about, and then partly the more general problems which unite Polish populism with Italian populism, British populism, and American populism. So there were three different historical layers, the last of which is actually evidence that Poland is now part of the West.
Ironically,
because they have our problems now. So, you know, in that sense, they have arrived in the West. Now, as you also know very well, this region, East Central Europe, has always been very dependent upon the wider international context. And my broad view is that if the wider international context again becomes favorable, if liberal democracy and liberal internationalism recovers in the rest of Europe, the prospects for East Central Europe are actually very good because there are very strong forces mobilizing in these societies to defend liberal constitutional democracy. The fact that Lech Wałęsa goes everywhere with that wonderful t-shirt saying Konstitucja, constitution, the fact that you have what Jürgen Habermas called constitutional patriotism emerging in Poland in the defense of this constitution, that the society is making its own these institutions of liberal democracy that in a sense were imported. That's all very encouraging. So that I think that given a favorable international context, we can be cautiously optimistic about the future for the region and specifically for Poland. And I think then the 40th anniversary of 1989 could actually be a more cheerful and optimistic affair.
So we may be in a period of testing of liberal democracy in Poland, but we conclude on a note of cautious optimism. Timothy Gartnash, thank you very much for joining me today.
It was a great pleasure.